Your patient has symptoms across multiple systems, and every test keeps coming back normal. When should mitochondrial disease be on your differential, and what are the early clues you can't afford to miss? On today's episode, we have Dr. Heather Gatcombe, who's a radiation oncologist at Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University and an assistant professor at Emory University School of Medicine. She's also the mother of a child with mitochondrial disease, leading to heart failure and transplant. She serves on the Board of Trustees of the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation, as well as the UMDF Scientific and Medical Advisory Board Clinical Training and Education Committee, which is why she's on the show today. As both a physician and a parent, she's dedicated to improving clinician awareness, shortening diagnostic delays, and advocating for patients and families affected by mitochondrial disease. You're listening to Succeed in Medicine, the show for practicing physicians who want to master the parts of their career and life that med school never prepared us for. From interpersonal skills to career navigation to the essential information every physician needs, I'm Dr. Bradley Block, and in every episode, we bring you brass tacks advice and immediately applicable insights from world-class experts so you can feel prepared wherever your MD takes you and build a life in medicine that's sustainable, rewarding, and actually worth all those years of sacrifice. Dr. Heather Gatcombe, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Brad.
So your son has mitochondrial disease. So when did you find that out? Tell us the story.
Oh my. So when he was about seven, I received a call that they actually thought he had a stroke because he went up to his teacher. He said his hand felt funny and then it became weak. And his teacher noticed that he had facial droop. And then he lost the ability to move the entire side of his body. So his teacher actually had to physically carry him to the nurse's office. They called 911. By the time EMS came, he actually looked like he was back to normal. So it had abated. I was in private practice. I had a 45-minute drive to the CHOA, we're in Atlanta, to the emergency room. And so when I got there, he looked like his normal self, but it was just terrifying. Why would a seven-year-old have a stroke? And I'm in oncology, so I'm going through all the worst-case scenarios. So we get there, and our best friend is actually the pediatric neurologist on call. And he said, you know, it's probably just a hemiplegic migraine. It's probably fine. It abated. We're getting all these tests. His blood work was normal. They eventually got an LP. That was all normal. But then they got a brain MRI, which showed some findings in the basal ganglia. It showed that there was evidence of swelling. So there was T2 and flare changes in the basal ganglia bilaterally. And once they ruled out, you know, toxic exposures like carbon monoxide or Wilson's disease, we were left with a diagnosis of probable mitochondrial disease that we had for about 5 years, 3 to 5 years. I can go more into that if you want.
So, I mean, how did they draw that conclusion of probable mitochondrial disease? Like, what were the clues that led them in that direction?
So he had what they now call a stroke-like episode or a metabolic stroke. And once they ruled all the other causes based on what was found on his MRI, then they said he had probable mitochondrial disease. And actually, that led us down genetic testing. So we got genetic testing right away. At that time, it took about 3 months to come back, and it actually all came back normal. So his mitochondrial DNA came out normal. They did specific panels, and then they did exome testing, but it was all negative. So they said, it looks negative, but we're still suspicious that this was mitochondrial disease. My husband and I are both physicians, so we didn't quite believe it without having any diagnostic proof. We wanted more evidence. We were kind of left in this like vague limbo for quite a while. So we did go out and get some second opinions. We went to Boston Children's. We did an online second opinion with Sumit Parikh at Cleveland Clinic. And our team eventually referred us to CHOP. And it was actually 3 years later where he actually had a muscle biopsy that showed his mitochondria weren't functioning as well. They actually do functional testing. Do you remember the Krebs cycle? Electron transport chain, oxidative phosphorylation. So they see what complexes don't work as well. I see you're smiling. I don't know if you remembered or not.
Well, the tagline of the show is everything we should have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle. And now you're making the argument that we really should be memorizing the Krebs cycle.
So I remembered it for that one time. I did great on all my tests, the steps or whatever. But I forgot all of that by the time you have a kid and get in. We are so specialized nowadays in medicine. I don't feel like I used it or heard it again until that time. But it was another 2 years after that before his genetics actually showed a pathogenic mutation in his nuclear DNA.
And that is because the mutation that he happens to have was not one that was previously identified.
Correct. We've only known about mitochondrial diseases for the past few decades. They identified the first mitochondrial DNA mutation back in 1988. So every year we're learning more. And so it was actually 4 years after he first started having symptoms that he had a VUS or a variant of unknown significance on his genetic testing, but they didn't know what it meant because there was nothing in the literature yet. But the following year, there was a publication with a few other kids from England that had some issues that were similar to what my son was going through, the metabolic strokes, and they also had heart issues, which he eventually developed. So then we had validation of this is why this was happening. This is what we need to do.
Okay. So you said that the metabolic stroke happened when he was seven?
The first one was at seven.
And so prior to seven, was he exhibiting any symptoms that you can now look back at or nothing?
So healthy, met all of his milestones. He was active. He was playing t-ball and then baseball and then soccer. And he was always a fast sprinter. He was doing well in school. The only weird thing that may have happened is he did tennis camp and he bumped into a 200-pound instructor when he was maybe about five. He hit his head and he had a concussion. So maybe in retrospect, that stressor with his mitochondria not working as well predisposed him to a neurologic event or concussion. I don't know, but he did black out when he was five. Wow.
Okay. Is that typical to present, or is it typical that they'll develop symptoms sooner than him?
That's a great question. So the problem is it's so heterogeneous, mitochondrial disease. So it's either caused by a mutation in your mitochondrial DNA that comes from your mother, and there's 37 genes on your mitochondrial DNA, but there's over 1,500 nuclear genes that code for proteins that are important for mitochondrial function. So a mutation on either one of those can cause some type of mitochondrial disease, but depending on where that mutation is and how severe it is, it can depend on how you present. So a very severe mutation, a child may die in infancy or in utero, but patients can present in adolescence and people can present throughout their life. There was actually a very interesting publication that came out 2 years ago. So the Odyssey 2 survey was published about 2 years ago looking at patients in the United States who were eventually found to have a confirmed mitochondrial disease. And they found that the median age of developing symptoms was actually around just under 15, but the time to diagnosis was actually 30. There was just a long diagnostic delay. So a young child, their diagnostic journey was much shorter, so they may present it more severely. And I think pediatric clinicians are more aware of mitochondrial diseases, and so they're more likely to diagnose them in a quicker pattern, get the right testing, get them in for genetic testing. But if an adult patient's presenting in their 40s or 50s and their symptoms may be mild, such as fatigue or GI issues, a lot of people can be misdiagnosed with other medical conditions. And on that study, they found that patients were misdiagnosed with psychiatric disease, GI disease, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, and other rheumatologic and autoimmune diseases.
Yeah, I mean, we just had an episode on menopause. And so those symptoms that you're describing that someone might be experiencing in their 40s also overlap significantly with menopause. And so, that can be really challenging. And so let's talk about the pediatric presentations and the adult presentations separately, right? So an adult who's having symptoms, what are the red flags that we're mitochondrial disease should be in our differential?
Perfect. So anyone who has diabetes or hearing loss, it should be suspicious, whether that's in a child or an adult. Anyone with unexplained strokes or stroke-like episodes or metabolic strokes, or unexplained seizures, or anyone with atypical brain lesion, especially in the gray matter, especially in parts of the brain that require a lot of energy, like the basal ganglia, that should make you suspicious. But, you know, there's mitochondria in every cell of your body except for your red blood cells. So it could potentially affect any organ system. So it can present very differently. Heart findings like cardiomyopathy or conduction defects are very common. As we said, endocrinopathies and diabetes can be common. Hearing loss is very common, as we said, but it can also affect the kidneys, the liver, the lungs. It can affect your vision. But some people may only present with mild symptoms like exercise intolerance. The key thing to see is if someone has a metabolic stressor, such as trauma, or has a reaction to anesthesia, or has a fever or an infection, and they have worsening of their symptoms, that is also suspicious as well, because that's how it commonly presents. Some type of metabolic stressor in someone where their mitochondria isn't working well can push them into a metabolic crisis or organ dysfunction.
Okay, so, you know, because it's mitochondrial and the mitochondria are where we get our energy from, so the stressor, so we're requiring a rapid bump in energy, the mitochondria are not able to keep up with the necessary output, and then there's an issue. And so whether that's happening in the basal ganglia or that's happening in other parts of the body, so it sounds to me like the metabolic stressor is like the key to the story that should point us in that direction. It all happened when? So is that correct?
That is true. And when my son had a number of metabolic strokes throughout ages like 7 to 10, but not all of them were due to a metabolic stressor.
Okay.
They could be occur after a fever, but there are some instances like that first instance, we don't know why he had it at that moment. But for people with mitochondrial dysfunction, mitochondrial disease, sometimes your body can compensate until it can't compensate anymore.
Okay.
But stressors are more likely to precipitate it.
Okay. And so what is the pathophysiology exactly?
So for primary mitochondrial diseases, it is because of a mutation either in your mitochondrial or your nuclear DNA.
And then what happens because of that?
Yeah, so it depends on the mutation. So at least for our child, when he had his muscle biopsy, they did functional testing to see what complexes didn't work well for him, but it could be different for different people. So there can be a decrease in the number of mitochondria, like mitochondrial depletion, but it could also be just the way the mitochondria, they may not function as well, depending on where that mutation is.
So it's a blanket term for any type of mitochondrial dysfunction, whether they don't function well enough, or there aren't enough of them, or they're missing some of the nuclear DNA, or the nuclear DNA is dysfunctioning that then has to interact with the mitochondria. So like it can present in many different ways because ultimately it's a blanket term for a number of different disorders.
Yeah, I would say primary mitochondrial diseases, it's a genetic disease.
Yeah.
Because there are other forms of mitochondrial dysfunction which can lead to heart failure or Parkinson's or ALS. And that's usually another instigator that leads to mitochondrial dysfunction. But with primary mitochondrial disease, it's due to a genetic mutation.
Okay. If you like this podcast episode, you're going to love the podcasts over at the Doctor Podcast Network. For instance, Telemedicine Talks. Telemedicine is revolutionizing healthcare. Dr. Lee Damasco and Phoebe Gutierrez, Telemedicine Talks, bring you to the forefront of this digital transformation, featuring insights from pioneers and practitioners. Stay ahead of the curve, subscribe to Telemedicine Talks, and navigate the future of medicine with confidence. And so what about the workup? Like, so if I'm a primary care provider or a specialist and I'm suspecting mitochondrial disease, do I send to a geneticist? Do I send to, like, I'm not even sure where to point this patient.
Yeah. So, and I didn't either because I didn't know anything about mitochondrial disease until we went through this journey. So if you have a mitochondrial or metabolic specialist at your center, you would go there first. And they're usually a medical geneticist. At some centers, they are neurologists. Medicine, we're a multidisciplinary team. So if someone has heart issues, you're sending them to cardiology. If they're having stroke-like episodes, you're working with your neurologist.
But to get the diagnosis, clinical geneticist, correct?
Clinical geneticists. Okay. Some neurologists will do the testing as well, but you Think genetics, okay. Genetic testing.
Got it.
And there is free genetic testing available through different organizations, including the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation.
So you talked about the presentation of adults, maybe young adults or, you know, older kids, but it can also present very young in the more severe forms. So how is that going to present?
So usually when children present, it can be more severe. So for example, one type of mitochondrial disease like Barr syndrome, children can present with heart failure within the first year of life. They can present other mitochondrial diseases. They have developmental delay. They may not meet their milestones. They may have other neurologic issues or musculoskeletal issues as well. But again, depending on where the mutation is, it can affect any disease, any organ system.
And so let's say I am a specialist. We'll just leave that vague and then you can fill it in later.
Okay.
And I have a patient that comes in with a diagnosis already of mitochondrial disease. Who are the specialists that really need to understand it because it's going to affect their management? And I have a feeling I know what you're going to say, and it's going to be everybody but you.
It's going teach to be us. Everyone.
Okay.
So we see our specialists at Beth Shaw Children's Healthcare of Philadelphia. They see both adults and kids, but most mitochondrial disease specialty centers, they'll see both. And you are going to have a multidisciplinary team. So you're going to see the neurologist, you're going to see the pulmonologist, you're going to see cardiology, you're going to see ophthalmology. They want to look at your retina. You're going to get pulmonary function testing, cardiac testing. When we go to CHOP, we actually see neurology, genetics, and geneticists all at the same time in the same room. We get physical therapies doing testing and measuring his strength at every visit, and they're following that chronologically. Yeah, it's a whole team. And the other thing is nutrition, because optimal nutrition is very important in patients with mitochondrial disease.
What about the specialists that you might see for, because there's still people who get problems that everybody else does, right? So let's say he needs to have his tonsils out, right? Like, what does the otolaryngologist need to know? What does the anesthesiologist need to know? What do the PACU nurses need to know? Like, what are we, being an otolaryngologist, clearly I'm going to ask about my own specialty, but like, what would you want those types of physicians to know?
I'm really glad you asked that, because we have to be very careful with patients in the perioperative setting. So many patients with mitochondrial disease cannot fast for a procedure. So the standard NPO at midnight, maybe some liquids until a few hours before, won't cut it for some of these patients. So actually, the last time my son had a metabolic stroke, he actually had a heart failure and had a heart transplant. So we have to go for heart caths for biopsies to rule out rejection. And so his 1 year cath, he had a fast, and then he had a reaction to anesthesia. He's very sensitive to anesthesia and was throwing up, and we couldn't maintain his nutrition, and he had another metabolic stroke. So now our team works with our team at CHOP. He's pre-admitted before every procedure. And I'm not saying every mito patient needs this, but some may, where they have to be pre-admitted the night before. He gets D5. He's allowed to drink Gatorade up until an hour before the procedure. But I think the main thing is communication with a mitochondrial specialist, because you don't want this patient to have a metabolic crisis. For our son, he has metabolic strokes, but for other people, they're at risk for having dysfunction, whether it's pulmonary or heart failure, which could be serious. So the main thing is avoiding metabolic stress and avoiding a catabolic state. We don't want these people fasting. We don't want them getting dehydrated. We have to be careful with hypo and hyperthermia. And they also can be more susceptible to certain anesthetics. So if you're using propofol, it's usually less than an hour. There can be different drug restrictions, but it depends on the mutation. And that's when a conversation is very important.
And so who is the specialist? Is it the geneticist makes the diagnosis and then someone else becomes your primary care provider? Or the geneticist stays with you? Like, so who am I contacting on that team?
Yeah. So for us at CHOP, our medical geneticist, Marnie Falk, and her team. So whenever our son has a procedure, our team at CHOA calls the on-call team at CHOP for mitochondrial disease. So it's usually a metabolic or a mitochondrial fellow. Usually it's the medical geneticist who follows and continues to follow the patient to make sure that they're being treated adequately. Many of these patients are on mitochondrial supplements and medical foods, and they often manage that as well.
Okay, so surgeons need to be aware for the reasons, and anesthesiologists need to be aware for the reasons you just described. Who else needs to be aware when a patient with mitochondrial disease ends up as one of their patients?
Everyone.
No. But what I'm saying is, like, you mentioned those specific stressors. You mentioned that they can't be NPO for the reasons that you described. So, like, what other issues are there that might affect our ability to care for them?
Understood. So I think whether they're admitted to a hospitalist team or a subspecialty team, it's important to just know that they have mitochondrial disease because they may not be able to tolerate certain medications depending on what mutation they have, and just being aware of that. So some people can have Depakote. Some people can have certain antibiotics. And you do a literature search, they'll list a bunch of medications that mitochondrial disease patients can't have. But that's not a general list. Some patients with mitochondrial disease can have that. You may see, oh, patients with mitochondrial disease can't have lactated ringers, but that's only the case if they have a lactic acidosis. So it's really a case-by-case basis, and that's why it's really important to speak to whoever's managing the mitochondrial disease, and that's usually medical genetics.
So how are mitochondrial disease treated? Because it sounds to me like it's avoiding certain things, right? Avoiding metabolic stress, avoiding a catabolic state. It's avoiding certain situations. But is there active management? And if so, what is it?
Yeah, great question. So at the beginning of our journey, we were just told, avoid heat, be careful with infections. And then we were told to start some amino acids called arginine, which is a vasodilator, and it prevents metabolic strokes. But it wasn't really until after he had that muscle biopsy that showed where his mitochondria weren't functioning well, that he was placed on a regimen that actually kept those metabolic strokes in check for about 2 years before he got really sick and had heart failure during COVID. But so for most patients, they're going to be on some type of mitochondrial cocktail that's tailored to them based on where their mitochondria or what complexes aren't working well. So they're usually based on antioxidants, some targeted vitamins and amino acids. It's basically trying to push the oxidative phosphorylation through, just add more precursors to help push it through. And then for our son, he's treated like a MELAS patient. So MELAS, metabolic encephalopathy and lactic acidosis, is a separate mitochondrial syndrome. He doesn't have it because he doesn't have lactic acidosis, but it has been shown that arginine prevents, can help improve neurological outcome after a metabolic stroke. So my son's been on arginine since he was 7, 8. And so that's been a key to his management. And when he is admitted with a metabolic stroke, he often loses the ability to use his arm or to speak. And then they start IV arginine. Often he's admitted to the ICU because it's a vasodilator. Blood pressures tend to drop. So you either need a central line or 2 IVs. So that's why he usually gets admitted to the ICU.
When you first reached out to me, you referred to the diagnostic odyssey that patients with mitochondrial disease go through. And so is there anything else that you'd like us to know so that we can help to shorten that odyssey?
Thank you. Yeah. So for many patients with mitochondrial disease, it can take 5 to 10 years or even longer before they're given a final diagnosis. And along the way, patients can see 7 to 8 doctors and often receive many misdiagnoses before they receive the correct one. And that's why I reached out, because we really want to shorten that diagnostic odyssey for patients. As we went over before, there are many misdiagnoses that patients receive. And the results of that Odyssey 2 survey show that once patients got a true diagnosis, the way their caregivers reacted to them was different. They were treated differently. They received more empathy. Obviously, their treatment changed, their diagnosis changed, but it also gave, you know, more validation And many patients join support groups where they can get the support they need. So I'm really here just to make more people aware about mitochondrial disease. If you suspect mitochondrial disease, if you're seeing a patient where there's maybe three or more organ systems involved and they don't have another diagnosis, or if they are having unexplained strokes or seizures or have unexplained lesions in the brain, you want to get them to a geneticist. You want to have genetic testing performed so these patients can get diagnosed earlier and treated appropriately earlier. And 6 months ago, I would have said there's no FDA-approved medications for mitochondrial disease. We now have two, and there's many more in the pipeline. So there's a lot of hope for mitochondrial families.
Very encouraging. So if we want to learn more, if we want to take a deeper dive into mitochondrial disease, what are some good resources?
So I would go to umdf.org. The United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation has great resources, both for clinicians and for patients. For patients, they have support ambassadors that patients can call and speak with. For physicians, there is their MitoU section where you can get CME credit. If you're interested in learning more, we also need more specialists in the pipeline. So UMDF has started a new clinical pathway. Or even if you're already in a residency or fellowship, you can receive grant funding for your institution to see mitochondrial patients as well, half a day a week, and come to our MitoMed meeting in June and present whatever you want to present to further the cause.
Amazing. So anything else before we close that you would like our listeners to know? Anything that you'd either like them to know about you and your journey or your son or mitochondrial disease in general?
Just want to say, if you have any questions or want to learn more, I would go to umdf.org. MitoAction is also a great resource. And I just want to thank you so much for increasing awareness of mitochondrial diseases and supporting this cause.
And thank you for all the work that you're doing. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means either you fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please write us a 5-star review, take a screenshot, and email it to me so I can send you a quick guide on how to earn patient trust in 20 seconds or less. Email me at brad@physiciansguidetodoctoring.com and feel free to suggest a topic or guest. I take your requests seriously. The views expressed on this episode are those of the interviewer and the interviewee and do not represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting makes it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or legal advice or really any advice. Thanks again for listening to Succeed in Medicine.